With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. And I am delighted to say that we are joined by returning guest Alim Khan, writer and director of a great feature debut, After Love, and also Chris Rowe, composer of the music for After Love. Alim, Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I asked you both back on now because, Alim, the last time we spoke, it was because After Love was playing at the London Film Festival. Now it is finally available and in cinemas. And I thought it was worth revisiting the film to talk about it again and also to talk about your relationship with Chris and how the music works. Just in case anyone hasn't yet seen it, first let me let me urge you to go and do so. You may have read my review in The Observer on Sunday. The story is essentially Joanna Scanlon plays Mary, who is a white English Muslim who converted many years ago in order to marry Ahmed, with whom she lives near the Dover Cliffs. After he dies, she discovers that the work that was taking him back and forth from Dover to Calais was also actually leading him into another life. He had a whole other life going on in France, which she knew nothing about. And she finds herself cast adrift, and therefore she makes the journey to France to find out about Ahmed's other life. Now, I know that we can say more than that about, you know, what the nature of the plot is, but I think let's, you know, let's be as circumspect as possible. Alim, firstly, I've read many interviews with you now since I interviewed you before. One of the things that you've said a few times is you said that you grew up with English Pakistani heritage and as both gay and Muslim. And so for you, duality was something that you understood. And you said that you led almost separate lives for many years. Just explain to me what you meant by that.
Well, I think, especially when I was at university and kind of, I guess, really discovering my sexuality, I went to uni in London. My parents were still in Kent, and I'm from a large family, a very large family. So it at the time, it kind of felt like I was, it felt like I was living two very separate lives. Although I was the same Alim when I went back home to my parents, there was a huge part of me that they had no access to. And that really weighs on you because you feel like you're deceiving people. You feel like you are, well, you're hiding a part of yourself, a really important part of yourself. So that was a challenging time. And when I did come out, you know, it's a rocky road, but I'm very fortunate that I have a really great relationship with my parents, and those kind of multiple identities within me have kind of aligned and are all kind of facing the same way now.
I love the fact that in the film, everybody has more than one identity. It seems originally that the key thing is that her husband Ahmed has been two different people to two different sets of people, but everyone we meet then turns out to be the same, whether it's the character of Genevieve, who is one thing to one person, another thing to somebody else, or the character of the son Solomon, who is Franco-Pakistani, has an allegiance to his father, appears to be at war with his mother, and yet also has a secret that he's keeping from everybody else. And right at the center of it is Mary, who initially we think is, well, she's the victim of this duplicity, but actually through a brilliant dramatic sleight of hand, because she's wearing a hijab and because she has a slightly servile manner, she's mistaken for a cleaning woman and suddenly becomes this kind of superpower invisible person in somebody else's life. So nobody in the film is exactly what they seem.
Exactly. And I think that is very true to life, because I think we all have multiple identities within us. And I kind of see it as kind of as like prisms. And, you know, as we turn, we reflect different versions of ourselves out to people. And depending on what day or who we're with, I think we all kind of code switch and we all learn to kind of adjust accordingly. This is a film about betrayal. It's about many things. It's about love. It's about identity, loss, obviously, but it's about betrayal. And all, as you say, all of these characters betray one another. They kind of betray themselves too. And for me, it was very important not to vilify Ahmed, not to kind of judge him, because all of these characters lie to one another. You know, as you say, Mary becomes complicit in Ahmed's deceit. Obviously, she's trying to understand the bigger picture and the truth, but she crosses some pretty, you know, big red lines. And for me, it's about putting the audience in the film, having the audience look at their own relationships, look at their own faceted identities, and I guess ask the question of, when are we ever authentically, completely ourselves? Are we? Can we ever be? You know, we're always modulating.
And there's a lovely thing, which is quite apart from that, you know, that everybody has got this kind of dual thing going on all the way through the film. And I've now seen it three times, and I noticed this more each time. All the way through the film, the duality of the central theme is mirrored in the shots. We constantly see shots that are mirrored against each other or reflect each other. We open with this astonishing shot, which is a still shot, a scene of domesticity, darkened kitchen, light in the background. Something's happening in the background off screen, in fact, which is really important, but you don't notice it. The very, very end, the camera creeps in, and that movement is then repeated throughout the film. We see scenes in which the sea and the bed are mirrored, in which the cracks in the cliffs and the cracks in the ceiling are mirrored. And one of the things I love most about the film is, having seen it three times, I've seen more in it each time. And it's really encouraging when you see a film and see more in it than when you see a film and see less in it. And believe me, that happens more often than you would think.
I'm really pleased that you've found more in it each time you've watched it, because it is a very subtle film that I'm saying a lot in that work, but it's very calibrated. And I think on first viewing, you are busy. I think an audience will be busy with certain aspects of the story. I do think once you've watched it a couple of times, the different angles, the different nuances, I think, kind of present themselves. I'm really pleased that you've seen more in it each time. Hopefully people that go to the cinema would go and see it three times. That would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Now, Chris, I'd like to bring you in here, because one of the things that's very important to that sense of duality and that sense of the tension that's at the center of the film is to do with the score. And I've played some tracks from it on my Scala show, and I'm very struck by how much certain scenes touch me because of the way the music works. As I was watching the scene when she crosses the channel and we have this, you know, the image of the cliffs collapsing, there's this tension in the music that reminded me, weirdly enough, of Nicholas Britell's brilliant score for Moonlight. A similar kind of, like, the feeling of the ground beneath you shifting. And I've now been listening to the score on its own, because I now have a copy of it. Thank you very much. And what's remarkable is that if you, having watched the film a few times now and then listen to that score on its own, the score is doing the thing that a film score really should do, which is evoking the film in my mind. What's the central theme for you, or the central sort of guiding principle of that score?
Yeah, for me, on the watching the kind of early cuts, it was I was just really struck by Joanna's performance and how she was. It's such a still film for so much of the film, and you know, there's very little said, actually, the dialogue track, and just seeing this kind of feeling, this kind of gut-wrenching thing that has happened to her, but she just does. She she just looks, I think when I first met up with Aleem, I just found, we were chatting about how she is just in shock for the whole film, really, for at least the first half. And I think musically, you know, that's definitely what drew me in, trying to get inside Mary's head as a character and bring that kind of that pain across. But you know, also the way that what we really wanted to do would not impose the music on the film, because it is such a still soundscape, but we wanted to have the music sort of trying to come out of the sound design, so thinking of the music, mm-hmm. Coming out of the wind, out of the waves, and you know, we spoke a lot about the kind of metaphors through the film, really, before even writing any notes, and speaking about, you know, how we could try and mimic the sounds of, you know, just taking the ferry horn in the distance, or the idea of a propeller, kind of a rusty propeller going round, and how that could kind of leak into the score. So really, I think, yeah, it's those two things of trying to get inside Mary's head and kind of enhance what she's doing on screen, but in a sort of subconscious way. I think if we can ride in on the sound design, then it can be, you know, I think a lot of people that see this film won't consciously notice the music, maybe until the end even, and I think that's, you know, that's kind of what we were going for, really.
Excusez-moi. Oh. Pardon, madame. I'm sorry. You are here for the cleaning? These can all go too.
What's wrong with these?
Ahmed doesn't wear them.
Did you convert when you married?
Back then, I did something for my husband that no one else could.
What's interesting is that, you know, when I was... because I had to write about this for The Observer, and I used the word seascape when I was trying to, because I was trying to, it's very difficult to ever describe anyone's music. You know, you if you write about music, you end up saying things that just sound completely platitudinous, but it's, there is a kind of floating thing to it, particularly when you listen to it in isolation. It also sounds like a number of different voices slightly talking against each other. And I was kind of interested because at one point, I noticed, well, firstly, the film plays out in English, French, and briefly in Urdu. The central character barely speaks. And the noise that you hear most of the time is the noise of everything else going on around. And I actually think that what the score managed to do was to evoke that idea that there are a bunch of voices around you, but you can't quite tell where they're coming from. And I that just really struck me. I wonder whether that just sounds like phony, baloney, pretentious nonsense to you.
It was quite important to us to, for the music to really be a mirror of Mary's kind of inner soul, you know, her inner turmoil, her inner journey. And when we were talking about the music and how it was going to, I guess, what it was going to represent, the elements of, so I also have to say that we had an incredible sound designer called Joachim Sundström, who is an incredible Swedish sound designer. And we worked, the three of us, very, very closely, because we kind of saw the score like waves with the kind of the sound design. We wanted the sound design to kind of lead the film and the score to kind of jump off and then kind of go back into this design. We wanted the music to feel very, not that you didn't, that you felt it more than you noticed it. And we kind of looked at, for me, it was kind of like seeing it in pictures. I kind of saw like the air sound. There's a lot of air, there's a lot of wind, there's obviously a lot of waves, there's a lot of rumbling in the earths and cracking. They all kind of represented different characters. So it's really interesting that you said different voices, because our approach was Mary was the earth, Genevieve was the water, Solomon was air, and Ahmed was the metallic sound, the ferry, the propeller kind of going between those two points. And so it was about starting from a place where it sounded very rusty, kind of fractured, where we didn't, the audience don't quite fully know what the melody is or where this rhythm is going. And as we go through the journey, as Mary begins to piece together this history and this life that her husband shared, the frame opens up in the cinematography and the score opens up to allow all of those fragments to kind of consolidate to become a piece that's fully expressed at the end.
We should say that, you know, you talk there about Ahmed, who is an absence in the film. That's from the very beginning, you think you're going to meet him, but you don't. You only do in kind of retrospect. Just for those who haven't yet seen the film, who is Ahmed? Where does he come from? What's his story?
Oh, what's his story? Well, Ahmed is Pakistani, and he was born in Pakistan and has lived in the UK for many, many years. He met Mary when he was a teenager. But I don't want to define him because I don't want to. I think it's
that's fine.
The audience.
That's fine.
It's for the,
that's kind of why I'm asking.
It's for the audience to find him and place him themselves. And you know, just kind of linking this back to kind of the sonic, you know, the sound, there's a lot of silence as well. You know, we use silence in the film, and there's only a few points where we go to absolute silence, but the absence of sound, of music, is just as powerful, is actually more powerful for me personally. I find that we hear that. It's such, and I remember when we were mixing the film, Joachim was really afraid that we were mixing it too low. For me, he was like, look, these layers are really, these are kind of on the edge. People might feel that it's too sparse. But for me, it was really about stripping out. I wanted every sound to have a reason for being there. And I want that silence in the auditorium. I mean, hopefully people aren't eating, but I want that, you know.
Have you been to a cinema recently?
I haven't had this experience yet where people are eating, thankfully. But, you know, it is a very quiet film. And I like that. I like that awkwardness that you get when you are in a cinema, in an auditorium, and something happens and there's that feeling that's shared. And when the music is lower and there's no kind of atmospheric sound, I mean, there's a lot of atmospheric sound in the film, but it's quite low. It forces us to listen and listen with our eyes in it as well. And
The other thing that I think is interesting, and one of the things I was trying to lead you slightly towards there with Ahmed is, what does Ahmed do for a living?
So Ahmed, I can obviously expand on those things. Ahmed is a captain of a ferry. So his job is obviously going back and forth between Calais, Dover, Dunkirk. And that has allowed him to live this kind of split life in many ways.
Yeah. So he's a man who was born in Pakistan, who lives in England, who has another life in France, and whose primary work is on the sea between places. So he is the very definition of a character in flux. And by the time we meet him, if you can actually say that we do, he's gone. And actually, I thought one of the sort of, it's kind of a ghost story.
Yeah, it is. It really is a ghost story. Yes, it is. And Mary, in the outfit that she wears, one of the images that I had on my desk when I was writing this, because my mum doesn't, so the character is very much based on my mum. The film isn't autobiographic, but there are a lot of real things in the film that the film explores that are very close to home. So my mum doesn't wear the niqab, that full long kind of, at the beginning of the film, the kind of the white dress that hits the floor. But there was this image that I had on my desk. I don't know who the photographer was, and it was in a woman wearing a full niqab, and she was facing away from the camera, and she was standing in this room about to pray, I think. There was a mat on the floor. And for me, it was like, she is a physical ghost. She was like, almost like that kind of classic ghost with a kind of bed sheet. It was like a woman who was like lost in this void of this cloak. And I don't know, the colour white was a very significant colour for me with this niqab, because it just mirrored this kind of the cliffs and the chalk and the foundations. And yeah, it is a ghost story. It really is.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Chris, I sent you a message, which is how this kind of got set up, because I said, I've got the piece, The Cliffs. I want the piece of music from the dinner scene. And you said, okay, well, actually it's called this, and I'll send you the whole thing. What's interesting is that there are a couple of moments, and there it's only a few, when things come together, and they come together, you know, harmoniously. And the score does something very interesting at those points. It's not that it goes from being suspended or, you know, augmented, whatever, and suddenly we get nice big, you know, C majors. But there is a sense that the score has these moments of warmth and harmony, but they pass like waves. It'll come together and then it will move on. Can you say something about that?
No, I mean, that's really interesting, because I think what we spoke a lot about was, well, I actually focused on that final scene was one of the first things I wrote, and it's definitely the most complete piece of music, you know, musically. And we actually worked, had this idea of breaking, that was in, you know, several layers, and breaking it apart into fragments and kind of distorting those fragments, putting them through different prisms. And and I think through the film, my approach was sort of a collage approach, so you kind of just piecing things together. And I think hopefully that we wanted to give the impression that Mary's world is just being thrown completely up in the air, and inside her head she's has all of these different things, different kind of fragments of things that she thought she knew colliding with each other. And that's interesting to sort of think of them as voices in that way.
So for me, it's everything is referencing everything, if that makes sense. Like they all have to work in harmony together to communicate, I guess, what I'm trying to say. You know, the production design, the costume, the performances, the dialogue, and the music, they're all kind of part of the tapestry. So it's a kind of slow food film. It's something that you need to be patient with, because it does, I think it pays off, but it does, you know, it takes a while to kind of, it's something that seeps into you. And that was something that was important for us in the framing, was to have that push in, you know, to gradually get closer to this character. And then as she embeds herself with this other family and develops a relationship, we allow the camera to move backwards to kind of see the frame. And the music, works in the same way. It's about piecing it together to hear the full sonic scape of it. Chris, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's beautifully put, actually. I mean, I think there's this kind of rocking motif that goes throughout the whole film, just two notes. And Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because it has its own kind of rhythm and it's just like it's sort of passing. But for other cues, it's sort of left suspended. And actually what you're saying about a ghost story, it's using the very kind of... it's using harmonics on the cello, which very kind of disembodied sound, like taken away from its the usual kind of warmth that we feel from the cello. And so, yeah, I think that must have been an influence in there. But... that moment is almost like two kind of ships coming together, I suppose, and it's such an important moment in the film for when I was watching the cut, it's when Mary kind of, you get a feeling that there's some sense of peace, she's found some kind of sense of, you know, up until this point she's just been in shock, I think, and then there's, you know, that kind of really beautiful moment between them, and just a, you know, a very simple act of cooking together. And and actually that was one of the first scenes that I saw that Aleem shared with me, and so that was, I think I had, you know, almost had written that part first and then extrapolated it backwards, so took those themes, fragmented them earlier on, and so when we get to that point, I think we're very familiar with those two notes, that kind of idea, and then when it sort of finally lands into more of a kind of, it's a waltz really, it's a kind of slow waltz between them, and so yeah, it's one moment where there is a kind of a rhythm to it, and you know, a set tempo, and it settles, doesn't it? It settles.
And how much does the tempo, the rhythm of that, how much of that is set by, forgive my pronunciation, is it Alexander Dinan or Dinan, the cinematographer? How do you pronounce the name, Alim? Dinan. Who, I think he shot Paul Schrader's first Reformed, which has a kind of, you know, a very particular aesthetic. How much is the tone of the music defined by, I mean, when I'm watching it as a, you know, as an audience member or as a critic, you kind of start looking at it and thinking, okay, there's this very particular framing, very particular slow moves, uncluttered. How much does that tell you what the score needs to sound like?
Yeah. For me, I think it's the scope, isn't it? So on that, in that, so much of the film is inside and quite close, quite close in, and I think musically, well, this was recorded just, there's only one instrument in the film, it is just the cello, an amazing cellist, Alice Purton, who I worked with, and so much of it is recorded really, really close as well, so you get all those kind of imperfections, and you hear the bow on the string, and you're brought right into the instrument. But then, you know, in that final scene of the film, as we pan out, as Aleem said earlier, that's when the kind of music rushes in, and it broadens in scope, just by adding lots and lots of those layers on top of each other. But so I suppose, yeah, that definitely. It's that definitely kind of affects the kind of how close in we are to the sound.
But it's also mirroring. It's mirroring Mary, because its own. I mean, Mary as a character is so constrained by her circumstances within this house, trapped within herself with this grief. And it's only in that, without giving spoilers away, it's only in that last kind of 15 minutes where something happens that allows her to fully release, and the music was a kind of a call to that, a reaction to that release, kind of pouring it out.
One of the things that I always think about with films, is this sounds completely superficial, is I think about titles a lot. I think about what the title of a film is. I just reviewed a film that's had its title changed recently. And as soon as I know something's had its title changed, I immediately need to know what it was called before the title was changed. And that kind of seems to be terribly significant. And I was thinking about what After Love meant. And what was interesting was that to me, it implied two things. The first thing it implied is aftermath, which is like, you know, the aftermath of something. But the other thing it implied was afterglow, as in the kind of, you know, tenderness and intimacy. And I, whether that's intentional or not, those two particular readings, I like the fact that that the title implied those two apparently contradictory things, one of which is completely destructive, the other of which is kind of warm and glowing. And I just wonder whether you want to say something about what, without explaining it, without, you know, he was a sea captain. Just tell me what it means to you.
I don't know how to articulate it. It's really tricky. I don't want to articulate it because I want people to decide for themselves. But for me, you mentioning this kind of this double meaning is true. It's, you know, it's after the event of something, but it's also after something. It's seeking. You can read it as it being, you know, after wanting love. And both of those things are very much what the film is about. But it's hard to kind of define, because I don't, because also, like, what is love? I mean, it's not my responsibility to explain it. It's really for the audience to kind of question for themselves. This is why it's always so hard, isn't it? Because, you know, because you really want audiences to make it their own. And if I tell them this is what it means to me, then they can only see it my way. And I always feel like the work, I've said what I wanted to say through the work, and then you put it out and then people make it their own and you can discuss it. But if I tell them now before they've seen it, then it's like, you know, there's no other reading. But I think the kind of duality of what something can mean really speaks to what the film is about, you know, beyond the kind of the initial expectation of something, it goes beyond that.
I have to tell you, the best answer anybody ever gave me when I was doing the, you know, a film critic asking questions and the person literally not wanting to reply at all was Harry Dean Stanton, who I interviewed about Alien many years later. And I just could not get him to say anything about it because he just doesn't like talking about his films. And I finally said, Harry, tell me about the set. You know, the set was the most enormous thing and it's a whole world. You know, walking into that set, what was it like? And he said, what was it like? And I said, yeah. He said, what was it like, the set? And I said, yeah. And he said, did you see the film? I said, yeah. He said, it was like that. And I kind of thought, yeah, I understand. All right. So, Chris, I'm going to throw this to you just to kind of bring things to a close. I've been playing your music away from the film on this radio show that I do on Scala. And I'm always aware that having a film music show is a strange thing because film music is written for films. And yet it also can be taken as a standalone thing. And some pieces of music work away from the films and some pieces don't. And it's not a flaw in them. It's just not what they're designed for. As the composer who wrote the music for the film, how do you feel about it being listened to away from the film?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think, obviously, I love the fact that people are listening to it far and wide, and you know, that's a great thing for the film and for the soundtrack. But I think particularly for this film, so many of the cues are so personal to the film and to that scene, and sort of feel like a lot of the process that we went through was about me writing something kind of bigger than some of the scenes maybe, and then sort of really stripping it back and to its kind of bare elements that would work. And because it is tied in so closely with the sound design and really kind of works off it, I think some of the cues, yeah, they there's a danger if it was played on its own that it would just kind of have a sort of emptiness to it. But then, you know, we never listen to music just completely. You know, there's always something else going on, isn't there, which kind of adds, you know, fits into it. So it's a tricky one, and that's why we put the last cue of the film at the top of the album, as the kind of title track, because of the process that in which it was written. You know, that was the fuller piece that we wrote at the end, from which everything else kind of was fragmented. So, you know, I think that kind of has a standalone quality to it, but if you kind of tune straight in at track four or track five, I think you have to kind of appreciate it after hearing the first track, if you like.
Okay. Well, then I apologize for playing individual tracks from it on the radio and probably completely destroying the work, but still sounded pretty good. Well, Aline, when you're walking around your house, you know, doing the tidying, whatever it is, do you feel I just slap on the... I'll slap on the After Love soundtrack.
Actually, I have been doing that a lot in the bath. I mean, I'm getting such a rush just listening to the music that Chris composed from our film. I mean, Chris is such a wonderful person to work with, and listening to the music at home, I'm listening to it every day. And this might sound really cringe, but I kind of thought that when I die, I'd really like that last track to be the Cliffs track to be the music. So I feel like it's such a personal film for me. It's my first film. I kind of feel like that's, and Dover is such a special place for me and my family, that it's kind of a piece of music that I will always, that I'll always listen to and carry with me. So I think Chris is right. It's absolutely tied to the film, but it's something that that is meant to be enjoyed and experienced. The way we find our way into anything is very personal. So I hope that people do listen to this, and I'm glad that you're playing the tracks individually as well, because I think it's also just highlighting Chris's brilliance.
Chris, since Aline brought this up at your funeral, what are we going to hear?
Well, I think it's got to be... So at our wedding, we had Stravinsky's Firebird. We got lots of musical friends, so we had like a huge kind of scratch orchestra. And I think the end of that is pretty special, right? I can't have my own music.
I'm being carried out to the sound of Elvis's American Triology, all of it, and everyone has to stand until the end. Aline, Chris, thanks ever so much for coming on the show. Congratulations on the film, which is currently playing in UK cinemas. As I said, I'd advise you to go once, go twice, go three times. You see more every time. Thanks ever so much. If you've enjoyed this podcast, remember to subscribe, tell your friends, do all the usual stuff. Visit our Patreon page, where there's exciting video of this conversation in which you can see Chris's incredibly well-appointed studio and Aline's very tidy room behind him, as opposed to the pit that I appear to be living in at the moment. Thanks for listening. Keep watching the skies, and see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.